let my people go when my servant returns. The story begins with that very discouraging picture of banishment of a great man to a very desolate, empty area. Two Hebrews struggling together when one said to the other, and Moses said, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian and found that well. "I have become a sojourner, an alien, a foreigner in a foreign land." The part of the story that we're giving consideration to this morning is taken from Moses, from a childhood to royalty and then to the birth of his own first child. From living as a foreigner in an urban Egyptian royal household until he is living as a foreigner in a rural Midianite priestly household. From the privilege of being a prince of the greatest nation on earth to the obscurity of criminal exile in the wilderness of Sinai. It brings us to the preparation for the great event of the book, which is named, of course, for the event itself, Exodus, and ends with that very ringing declaration from Moses, "I have become a sojourner or an alien in a foreign land." The path that Moses chose, a path by faith, was frightening in its cost. If you have your Bibles, you may give consideration to the book of Hebrews for just a moment. Let me read several verses from the NIV, from Hebrews chapter 11. "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God, rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible." Hebrews 11 is filled with encouraging stories of the people of God, and yet all those who are named in the earlier part of this chapter before we get to the account of Moses are good examples to us, no doubt about that, but we really cannot relate exactly to them as we can to this man, because we cannot do exactly what they were led to do. We're not called upon to offer a literal sacrifice like Abel was. We're not asked to build an ark like Noah. We're not asked to leave our country and live in tents like Abraham was, and we're certainly not called to offer up Isaac in sacrifice as was Abraham. Moses, however, is a little different story. He is asked to make a decision for his Lord in the midst of very challenging, tempting circumstances. He is asked to make the kind of choice that you and I are faced with frequently, the choice of following the way of faith or following the culture around us. He, like us, is asked to count the cost, as Jesus taught in Luke chapter 14. He, like us, had some costs with that choice, and therefore, his story of these early verses in the book of Hebrews resonate very closely to us, and it's his story I want to give some consideration to this morning. I'm not sure who wrote this, and hence I've given it anonymous as its source, but it's a great word and great summary. Bred in a palace, he espoused the cause of the people. Nursed in the lap of luxury, he embraced adversity. Reared in the school of despots, he became the champion of liberty. Long associated with oppressors, he took the side of the oppressed. Educated as her son, he forfeited the favor of a princess to maintain the rights of the poor. With a crown in prospect, he had the magnanimity to choose a cross. For the sake of his God and Israel, he abandoned ease, refinement, luxuries, and the highest earthly honors to be a houseless wanderer. Quite a choice. And it's that choice I want to give some consideration to. It's a choice which included suffering. it cost Moses to do what he was about to do. He left the court of Pharaoh, the mightiest nation in the world, and aligned himself with a despised people. They were enslaved and persecuted, looked upon with suspicion, distrust, dismissal, neglect, rejection. Anyone who befriended them was almost certainly to have the same kind of attitudes reflected to themselves. Moses chose suffering. To anyone looking at the scene and situation, it would seem that the deliverance of Israel out of slavery was impossible. The obstacles were simply too great. Their power was too weak. To have any type of promises fulfilled to them where they would get their own country seemed a dream utterly unlikely to come to fruition. Anybody that chose to attempt to make them make that dream happen was certainly going to face pain and trials and distress and mocking and scorn and difficulty, perhaps even death. Yet with his eyes open, Moses chose suffering. Now please keep in mind that Moses was a person just like us. You and I are given two choices of action, of things to do in life. We are going to probably tend to choose the one that hurts the least, that gives us the least amount of difficulty, the least risk, the least pain. No one chooses well to hurt. And yet, this man chose suffering. Knowing very clearly what probably lay ahead of him, he nevertheless chose. Just like us, with just the same reluctance to hurt that we have, yet he chose a path at frightening cost that was filled with suffering. He identified with slaves. He said, "The children of Israel are my people. That's who I am. I'm only the adopted son of a wealthy foster Egyptian parent. Yes, she is the daughter of Pharaoh. Yes, royalty is perhaps offered to me, but that's not who I am. My people are the people of Israel." So he walks away from rank and riches and royalty and the realm of the greatest empire in the world, and instead casts his lot in, aligns himself with the slaves, bondservants, laborers, the oppressed, destitute, despised, afflicted, tormented, simple laborers in the brick kilns of Egypt. What a choice! He aligned himself with something that was both suffering, and he identified himself with the slaves. That was quite a decision to make. He wasn't just sympathetic with them. He didn't simply say, "My, how they suffer. Someone should do something about this." He chose their lot. We can hardly identify with this. If a wealthy person sold their house on the Gold Coast in Chicago, gave their proceeds to the Pacific Garden Mission, deeded their condo in Palm Beach in Florida to be sold and given to the Salvation Army in a raffle, if they liquidated their stock portfolio, left their gorgeous multi-million-dollar home and entered into a one-bedroom apartment in Englewood, Moses did much more than that. That is just a faint reference and analogy to what Moses actually chose. He didn't simply choose poverty, hard enough that that was for someone who would never experience this. He instead chose to align himself with the people. He chose not only suffering, not only slavery, but he chose scorn. This choice was identified and invited scorn. We don't use that word very much. We have other words for it: mocking, bullying, making fun of, being name-called. Think of this. People would tell him he was mad, foolish, silly, backward, utterly unreasonable. People will fall on grenades. They'll take a bullet for someone else. They'll rush into a building, burning building, to save a life. But they will have their choices in life changed because they're fearful of someone making fun of them. We don't think peer pressure, verbally expressed when you are mocked, is powerful. It happens all the time. Teenagers make choices because they're afraid of being made fun of. Christians in the workplace refrain from saying something because they might be made fun of. We choose in life because we do not want to be considered out of touch, foolish, silly, strange, peculiar, weird, extreme, religious. We forget that Moses would have faced the kind of looks, the kind of words, the kind of laughter that's very difficult to stand against. Sticks and stones may break bones and names will never hurt me. Whoever said that really hadn't lived very long. Bones do heal. Wounded spirits sometimes never are the same. Such were the things that Moses chose when he chose this path. He chose suffering. He identified with the slaves. And he invited scorn and abuse, the likes of which we can hardly imagine. Not only that, none of this was forced upon him. He chose it all. He deliberately looked at the options before him and said, I will walk this way. This is my choice. I'm giving up this, and I'm choosing this. Such a cost, such a decision, such a commitment surely should raise within us the question, why? What possible motivation? What was the engine driving this choice? What was the fountain at the undergird of all of this instance in Moses' life? Well, if his deliberate path was very frightening in its cost, then the very definite principle he chose was simply faith in his God. To choose what most would have regarded as foolish or extreme or wasteful or narrow or absurd or foolish or unsophisticated or unpatriotic, even treasonous, surely needed a motivation. And this was the source of his choice. I don't know what's more amazing about this word in Hebrews, because it's the Hebrew text that tells us what it was and why Moses chose. Whether it's its greatness or its simplicity, it's wrapped up in a single word. That is the word faith. Moses believed. By faith, Moses chose. By faith. That was his defining principle. Give consideration for a moment to what this entailed, what he sensed with his faith, what it was anchored upon. Faith had some pillars. This is what his faith was comprised of. This is what he trusted in, that his God had a plan. He believed, or it was revealed to the eye of his mind, and the very depth of his heart, that a Savior was one day to be born from the stock of Israel, that mighty promises had been given to this captive, oppressed people, and the time for the beginning of fulfilling part of those promises was at hand, and he was to play a role. Moses believed that. He put stock in it. He bet his life on it. And every single step in the wonderful career that we're going to look at over the weeks to come comes from this very source. Leaving a Pharaoh's court, identifying with the slaves. Choosing suffering, slavery, and scorn over ease, refinement, and promotion was because he was giving his faith its lead. And this faith believed that God had a plan. It was a faith that believed God kept his promises. Sure, looking at the situation of the slaves, who could imagine that this rabble, without property, without power, without prestige, had any hope ever of being delivered or of leaving slavery? But Moses believed that God had a purpose and that God was a promise-keeping God. He believed that. God had a plan. God had purposes. God was powerful. Things that looked impossible to people, he believed was probable to God. Nothing was too great or too difficult for God to overcome. He believed that. That's what it meant when the book of Hebrews says, by faith. This faith had pillars. It included God's plan, God's promises, and God's power. Faith to Moses was a telescope to the future. I've only looked in telescopes just several times in my life. It's an incredible experience. It truly is. You look at something with your eyes and it's indistinguishable or beyond your sight. You peer into a telescope and suddenly that which was invisible becomes clear. Telescopes are especially valuable in the looking into the sky. A little Far Side cartoon of years ago showed Carl Sagan as a little boy standing on a hill with his kindergarten girlfriend pointing up and saying, "Look, Lucy, the stars, there must be hundreds of them." He was to find out later on through the eye of a telescope that he was a little underestimating the depth of the sky. In a sense, Moses' faith was a telescope. It allowed him to look into the future with great clarity and see the wonder of God's perspective. It showed him what was going to come. I think it showed him that there were future rewards far greater than what he might have had simply staying as a prince in Egypt. And he needed that sight, because around him, where he could touch and sense and feel and experience, was great wealth and riches. But his faith told him there was something greater that cannot be lost, that will not corrupt, that will not tempt, that will be forever. It gave him a sense of rewards into the future and told him to look away from the dazzling riches around him. Faith told Moses that these despised people of God, these Israelites, these Hebrews, were special. To them, as an apostle was to write centuries later, belonged the adoption, the covenant, the promises, the glory. Of them was the seed of the woman to be born who would crush the head of the serpent. That's what Moses saw in faith. He believed that there was a reward that was coming. He believed that there were results in the future. He believed that these slaves would not always be slaves. He believed that one day they would be given to a land of their own. He believed one day that the kingdom of God would come to this earth, that there one day would be peace and rest and glory, not suffering and pain and trial and sin. He strongly looked to the future. Not only did faith give him a perspective, but faith led him to put that perspective into practice. Hebrews tells us that Moses chose the disgrace of Christ, or the scorn of Christ, or the mocking of Christ. In other words, faith said to Moses, value Christ, because he will reign. He will remain. He will be forever. That's what you are to value. That's what you are to take and embrace. It's honorable to be disgraced for Jesus' sake. It's honorable to be mocked for Jesus' sake, because Jesus will one day reign. The kingdoms that now in their arrogance stand against him will one day fall. The greatness of a Jesus we now just perceive by faith will one day be filled with sight. One day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that he is Lord. Moses saw that and he said, I will value that because Jesus will reign. I'll value earth less because it will be replaced. All this greatness and value and wonder that I see around me is not going to last. Moses saw below the surface. He saw with the eyes of faith that all that was around him was only for a moment. It was one day going to crumble to dust. He saw with his eyes of faith that all that has been tempting me now, all that I could grab and hold on to, is one day going to disappear. Can you see why his example is so practical to us? Not asking us to kill our son or build an ark or leave the country. But he's asking us, he's showing us, he's encouraging us to every day have the faith that he exhibited, to look at our world and see the values that we should have. To do exactly that, to say, my God has a plan. He keeps his promises and he is powerful. To see that my God has shown me the rewards of the future and the results that will come to me if I trust him. A God who asked me to value Christ because he will reign and not value this earth equally because it will be replaced. Moses could live in our world. He could sit in the pew next to us. He could go to work with us tomorrow morning, go to school with us on Tuesday, walk the neighborhood on Wednesday, and relate instantly. He would tell us, dear brothers and sisters of mine, follow my faith. I had to choose, and so do you. Our story not only lays out for us and answers so wonderfully the motivation for Moses' great faith, but it also shows God's action in his life. Here again, some tremendous practical senses for us. Moses speaks to us even though he's dead. Pharaoh's daughter's name was, I have no idea. The palace that he lived in is located, not sure. But every time we open the Bible and mention the name of Moses, we're instantly right there. The treasures of Egypt are some sitting in a museum. The treasures of Jesus are yet ahead of us. What great faith. God had a purpose for Moses. He was going to fashion him for leadership. It's not difficult to imagine why Moses was disliked at this point in his life and where the news about his murderous act had spread so widely. There was an Egyptian overseer missing. An investigation was about to take place. It wouldn't take very long before someone said, "Say, I know what happened. I saw what happened. I heard what happened," and was about to tell the story. It was the talk of the community, both among the slaves. "Do you know that the prince of Egypt killed an overseer?" And pretty soon in the royal household, "Do you know what the prince did to one of his own in favor of the Hebrew slaves?" Moses needed to be rescued. He acted in faith and trust, hoping to help someone, and he thought he'd succeeded. But God had something else in mind. And now in the process of his intervention to help his own people, God steps in his life to not only rescue him, but to relocate him. Moses was now clearly separated from his Egyptian ties, but he couldn't remain in the country. Where could he go that would be relatively safe from Egyptian influence, relatively hospitable to an Israelite in the sense of having some custom sharing and some linguistic connection in some way, and relatively easy to get to quickly from northeast Egypt? The answer was pretty apparent to Moses, who perhaps had to pack his meager belongings quickly and flee, and that was the nation of Midian, a group most likely located, descended from Abraham by his second wife. Details relayed to us in the book of Genesis that Moses later was to put to writing, was occupied sparsely, perhaps in the central and northern Sinai Peninsula or northwestern Arabia. To these people would Moses go. And it's interesting how the story begins to play out as to where God was working on Moses. The priest of Midian had seven daughters. A single guy finds a man with seven daughters. God is an amazing God. "They came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came." The shepherds came. Tells us this is an ongoing occurrence. "Drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them. Watered their flock. When they came to their father Reuel, he said, 'How is it that you've come home so soon? An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock.'" Moses is not simply rescued out of danger. He's not simply relocated to Midian, but his character is now revealed. How consistent, how this man's life has been formed, and how God is now about to take those things he's already implanted in Moses and use them. Consider in just this simple account of driving shepherds away from a well in Midian, we see the character of Moses. He was quick to act against oppression. He is a deliverer, whether it be from Hebrew slaves or from rude Bedouin shepherds. He is about to step in against all odds. He is either imposing enough or strong enough or wise enough to defeat a group of shepherds by himself, and strong enough to do the work of seven maiden girls sent to water their father's flocks. He's quite a guy. Charlton Heston was perhaps well cast in that role. He was generous and helpful to people he hardly knew, never met them before, saw a need, knew he could meet it, and delivered them. And all these characteristics God is going to use and form and fashion for leadership later on. It reminds us that God puts things into our life and character, and it's those very things that he desires to use for us, for his glory. It's amazing. He will use our giftedness, our talents, our interest, and use them accordingly. Moses was fashioned in several ways. He was fashioned in this new residence, the wilderness. We're not sure exactly where Midian was. I hinted, and perhaps with some accuracy, that it may have been located in the Sinai Peninsula in northwestern Arabia, close enough to be reached, but wide open, desolate territory. It was here in the wilderness that God began to fashion this man. What practical senses it was for God to lead Moses here. Because in a few decades, it was to this exact same place that Moses was to return, this time, not alone. He and the mercy of God is driven to the wilderness. Same way Jacob was once driven to the wilderness to see God appearing to him in a stairway to heaven. A place where John the Baptist was driven to proclaim the truth about the coming Messiah. A place where Jesus was driven to resist temptation. A place where the Apostle Paul even found a spot to reorientate his entire faith experience, to redo his theology in light of the risen Jesus. The wilderness is a place where God was able to meet people. But it was also a place where Moses was able to learn some practical lessons. Lesson number one, I now know this place. I know trails. I know where water is. I know the best route to go. Even though God was to lead them by pillar and cloud, it still helped to have someone who was there before. It was a land that Moses found and knew and was to be experienced and led through. And when he later was to lead the people to God's holy mountain, it was through this same region. Not only did he find a land, but he left a palace. It's interesting when he comes to name his son, a point I'll come to in just a moment, he calls him, related to his own experience, I have become an alien or a sojourner in a foreign land. We sometimes quickly read that and think, oh, Moses, the Egyptian, easily identified by Reuel's daughters as such, is talking about now being in Midian. I'm like a foreigner here. I'm an Egyptian in Midian. But I don't think that's the case. He says that word in the past tense. He is saying Egypt now is my foreign land. I'm a traveler, a sojourner, an alien there. He not only found a land, he had now left the palace. Not just physically running for his life, but spiritually and emotionally. I've distanced myself from all that was mine. I was a stranger there. And now I'm coming to someplace new. God fashioned him in his residence. God fashioned him in his relationships. Reuel, when he hears the story from his daughters, is rather interested at how could you possibly leave a bachelor like that out at the well? Please invite him to come into our home. And as things went in the course of events, Moses records for us this instance because it is here he meets his wife. I don't know whether he had an affectionate nickname for her, or whether Zipporah was on his lips for the rest of his days, but it is the name of the eldest daughter and the one to whom Moses connected. Not only he arrived as a single man and became married, but he arrived without children and birthed a son, fathered a son. Gershom sounds very much like the Hebrew word to drive out or to expel. And Moses uses that as a reference to his own experience. I've been driven out. I have been exiled to a new place. Not only did he find a wife and gain a son, but he followed an example. I put in two names here for Jethro Reuel. Reuel is how he's called here as we're introduced to him the first time. It literally means a friend of God. And it was most likely a tribal name, a surname, what you and I would reference as a last name. Because we know this man several times later on in the Exodus story as Jethro. So I'm assuming that though they didn't use first and last names the way we do, we can think of him as Jethro Reuel, the servant, the friend of God. In this home, and the Midianites might not have been spot on accurate in all their approach to God, but they knew something, and what they knew truly. It seems significant that Reuel was a priest and was able to tell Moses more about the faith that he was just becoming into a dawning sense of. So in all these relationships with wife, with child, with father-in-law, he's now learning how to love and serve a wife. He's learning how to raise and discipline and parent a child. He's learning how to relate to other people and to be taught of his faith, experiences that would serve him well. He's fashioned in his residence, he's fashioned in his relationships, he's fashioned in his resume. work not easy to come by in the deserts of Midian, and since his new father-in-law was a shepherd, Moses decided to become a shepherd too, which was quite a step for a prince of Egypt. You remember in the Joseph story, the reason why the brothers of Joseph couldn't eat with the Egyptians is because the Egyptians looked upon shepherds as despicable. They wouldn't eat with them. Now Moses chooses as the prince of Egypt the very vocation that was so looked down upon in his background. And I'm glad he did. A lot of great people in the Bible started out as shepherds. It's a pretty honorable profession, and God is able to use it for very practical reasons. Shepherding is a lot like leading people. Sheep are not always the wisest. They're very weak. They wander very easily. They need to be protected. Moses, in the simple act of serving as a shepherd to a few, and I say this with tenderness, dumb sheep, was able to learn some good lessons about protection, caring, providing, choosing, defending. God was able to use his resume to fashion him for leadership. The Bible comes back over and over and over again to those references to shepherding, and it uses God's relationship with us in the same way. In the words of the psalmist, we are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Psalm 100. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and by the hand of Aaron. How beautiful does God speak to that instance here so beautifully. He was working in Moses' resume, in his relationships, in his residence. How we instantly connect with that, because that's what we have in life. We live in a place. We have relationships. We perform a work or a task. And it's good to see God working and fashioning all of that. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10 says this, we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. God not only has prepared good works, he's prepared us to do them. And he does this through the ordinary experiences of life. God uses our mistakes and our failures even to fashion us for his purposes. The late James Boyce once wrote, God can teach us through failure of our own plans that he is capable of working for us and in us in spite of us. Only after we fail do we become aware that it is God and not ourselves who is working. God uses our living situation, our residence, where he has put us to work. Even if our residence is temporary, even if it's not a place we particularly love and enjoy, God has placed us there. He uses our relationships. Those of us who are married know that we often learn our best spiritual lessons from our spouse. The encouragement, the melding together, the working out of life, God teaches us great things. For those who are single, God teaches them great things as well. To be dependent upon a God who provides and serves them and meets their needs in dramatic and unusual ways is a way God works through relationships. God works through our resumes. For Moses, being a shepherd was great training for eventually being a leader and a pastor. God works in our work situations too. How many times do we see instances in the workplace that are examples and opportunities for us to sharpen or express our faith? This is why the great lesson of Moses is so wonderful for us. He was shaped and molded in exactly the same way that God shapes and molds us today. We relate to him immediately in every step of his life. And whatever our present situation, we should look to see how God is using and shaping that for his good and his glory. Among the many wonderful and wise things that John Wesley wrote over his long years of ministry, this was one of them. A prayer that he recorded in his diary later in life. Put me to what you will. Rank me with whom you will. Put me to doing. Put me to suffering. Let me be employed for you or laid aside for you. Exalted for you or brought low for you. Let me be full, let me be empty. Let me have all things, let me have nothing. I freely, wholeheartedly yield all things to your pleasure and disposal. That was a man who, like Moses, chose the path of faith. I leave you with this practice and a couple of things that struck me from the Moses account this morning. Our witness can, and I would suggest should, be distinct. Are we willing to give up everything and follow God? Do we have an Egypt that is calling and pulling to us that we are not willing to surrender? One old author said, is there a cross in your Christianity? Is your faith sharp-edged, or do you sort of fit in? I was driving last week to breakfast with our daughter after watching our granddaughter play a soccer game, and Amy, who was sitting in the front seat with me, looked at her phone and said, my phone is low, I need to charge it. To which I said, good news, I happen to have a charger right here in the van, and I reached down for it and pulled the wire up, and she looked at me and said, I have an Apple phone. That charger does not fit. I thought this week and said, what an interesting and powerful statement. And what spiritual applications. How many times do we attempt to fit in a world that is simply not geared for us? Rather than us being obnoxious and simply saying, I'm opposed to that, I'm against that, how about we just say, I just don't fit. It doesn't fit me. I don't fit in with that. That's not a fit. All the temptations and challenges and actions and words and behaviors, it just doesn't fit. My Apple phone requires an Apple charger. Now, Apple probably did that to make a dollar or two on chargers, but the principle is still great. God did not make us, brothers and sisters, to be universal. He made us to fit. And we don't always fit in here. Our witness can be distinct. How? We have to have the exact same faith that Moses had. It was a faith that helped Noah go on to build the ark. Even though people made fun of him, undoubtedly, it was the same faith that led Moses to give up the land to his nephew. It's the same faith that Ruth said, I will leave my home and follow my mother-in-law because I believe in the God that she loves and honors. The faith that led Daniel to keep on praying when the political pressure was great upon him. It was the faith that led his three friends to say, we would rather die in the fire than stand for a statue. That's the kind of faith all of them had. They saw the future. They looked at future rewards, future results. They had a telescope to their trust, and they believed. John Ryle, the great Anglican churchman of a century ago, said, you must learn to believe promises better than possessions, things unseen better than things seen, things in heaven out of sight better than things on earth before your eyes, the praise of the invisible God better than the praise of visible man. Then and only then will you make a choice like Moses and prefer God to the world. How true. Let's pray. Father, even though we don't live in Egypt, we are not slaves, we're not oppressed, we connect immediately with the example of Moses and how thankful we are for you listing his story in these ordinary details in our Bibles. Help us sharpen our faith and because of that our witness in the world in which we live. Help us choose you over that which is around us. You last. This earth doesn't. Build within us the ability to make good choices and to call others to an eternal place of glory and good. For the sake of Jesus, our Savior, who identifies with us and won this path for us.